From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, a Milwaukee area neurologist looks for the root causes of physician burnout in the 21st century.
Later, we'll learn about the rise of Walker's Point as a center of gay life and culture in Milwaukee.
It all started at that corner of 2nd and Pittsburgh in 1968 when, you know, people saw that, you know, they saw themselves reflected in the world. They saw businesses that were welcoming and accepting. They saw that they too could have a neighborhood for them. And they just kept coming.
And a new album by the Milwaukee band Paper Holland channels a summertime tropical feel.
I think we definitely like set out to establish that vibe. Beyond that, I'm not really sure. It's kind of just like, you kind of know like a summer jam when you hear it.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us today. Earlier this week, we heard about research into why some doctors treating underserved patients burn out while others stick with a profession. But burnout is not limited to physicians in urban settings. It's an issue that, to use a medical metaphor, is endemic in the profession.
It is a phenomenon that Milwaukee area neurologist Dr. Bhupendra Khatri has witnessed and which troubles him greatly. Khatri's recent book, Healthcare 911, explores the causes he sees playing into the burnout dynamic and some both short-term and long-term remedies for it. Khatri joined us in the studio to explain. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me here, Mitch.
What was the catalyst for this book?
You know, I have been traveling extensively throughout the country over the last 4 to 5 years. And I've spoken to hundreds of physicians. And I hear the same story, that they're not happy. They're not happy because, you know, their practices are being increasingly taken over by hospitals and larger corporations, which put profits before patients. They are, once they're hired, the administrators and the hospitals and the larger corporations take control over the health care. They call all the shots. The health care has changed dramatically over the last two decades. It's turned upside down, whereas before the physicians used to control, now it's the healthcare administrators who run the show. And that has put a lot of stress and burden on the physicians.
I don't imagine that practicing medicine was ever easy. It's not a field that people would go into if they want an easy life. But it sounds to me like a lot of the practice of medicine was easier when you got into the field.
You know, physicians always worked hard. We always put in long hours for years. And we enjoyed doing that, taking care of the patients. And we put in the same amount of hours now, but it's under different circumstances. It's not directly related to patient care. We are burdened by a lot of things. For example, electronic health records, which interferes with our relationship with our patients. It does not allow us to contact and have a good relationship with our patients, right? There's a lot of regulatory guidelines. We are told how many patients we must see in an hour. We have to record everything. Then we have to deal with insurance companies, which is another nightmare. And it's increasing. So it's the circumstances under which we work right now which is causing the burnout. And, you know, more than 55% of the physicians in this country suffer from burnout. And every year, more than 400 physicians kill themselves because of that.
And I want to talk about some of the areas that you were just speaking about, because there are some that might seem on their surface to be counterintuitive, that they'd be a problem. Changes that on their face seem as though they ought to be helping doctors and their patients, but you write that it hasn't turned out that way. You mentioned electronic health records to start with. This is an area that I think people might imagine allows for some standardization and for things not to fall through the cracks, that one doctor looking at what another doctor has written about a patient might be able to better access this patient's important health information. Why have electronic health records been such a challenge for doctors?
So, Mitch, you're absolutely right. You know, when electronic health records became mandatory for physicians and hospitals to use it in 2009, it was considered to be a boon. We thought this was going to help us. In reality, it has turned out to be a major problem. American Medical Association president, Dr. Stephen Steak, expert in electronic and digital healthcare, one of the youngest physicians ever appointed, he made the comment that electronic health records has been reduced to, for billing purposes, for litigation, and for regulations, right? It does nothing for the physicians who is taking care of the patient. In fact, it interferes because we have such a limited time with our patient, and we bring in the computer, and we're looking at the computer all the time, and we're not even looking at the patient, and we're not connecting with the patient. So our relationship is being eroded with the introduction of the electronic health records. And as you know, medicine is an art. We have to listen to the patient. We have to observe them. We have to examine them. We want to hear them. And if we cannot do that, how are we going to take care of our patients? And let me give you an example. When I was writing my book, there were three young physicians. Said, Dr. Khatri, you're old. You're not used to electronics and typing, and that's why you're so critical. And I said, that's not true. You know, physicians, no matter how old they are, if the technology is going to help the patients, we embrace that. So I said, well, let's do an experiment. So I told them, go see this one patient individually, but take your computer and come out. And then I send them to see another patient. And I said, don't take the computer. Do it the old-fashioned way. And when they came out, I asked them, what was the color of your patient's eyes? And the first group who took the computer, zero. They could not tell me the patient's eyes. The other group that did it the old-fashioned way, they were 100% correct. Now, that tells you something. If you cannot even look into your patient's eyes, how are you going to heal them? So electronic health records, on one hand, Mitch, you're right, it is supposed to streamline. We can have access to the records, the labs, and everything. But physicians have been reduced to data entry, and that's not right because we have limited time with our patient, and we're there to help them, not to put data into the computer.
Would you imagine there is a way to do electronic health records right so that it serves both doctor and patient?
I think there are a lot of ways we can do that. I think when it became mandatory for electronic health records, it was never put to test. So we never had a chance to see how this is going to pan out. Now, I think we do have ways to make it better. One, the electronic health records should be able to talk to each other. And so if a patient goes to one clinic or to another hospital, I should have an access. Right now, it's so difficult. Other thing is having a scribe. You know, having a scribe in the room makes it easier. But then you have to pay for the scribe, and who's going to pay for that, right? We ask the administrators to give us a scribe, and they say it's not in the budget, right? So there's financial constraints. For individual practices, first, getting electronic health records is expensive. And then getting a scribe that you cannot bill for, how are you going to afford it, right? And the other thing is that, you know, when the Affordable Care Act was brought in, Dr. Robert Koch was the only physician who sat on the National Economic Council, which ushered in the Obamacare. They realized that when 25 million or so population will get into the insurance, now will have insurance, they felt that the individual practices will not be able to take care of those patients. They felt we needed larger corporations, larger hospitals to take care of them. So they put in place regulations and that would favor larger corporations and hospitals but disfavor individual physicians. They cut down their reimbursements, procedures that they would do. They would be paid less as opposed to the hospitals and larger corporations and clinics. So as a result, these private individual practices started to shut down. They could not afford to survive. So in that setting, to ask them to have electronic health records as well as to hire a scribe, it's difficult. And Bob Kocher wrote an op-ed in Wall Street Journal in 2016 saying how wrong he was about the Obamacare. One of the things that he said was he now realizes that individual doctors know the patients best as opposed to the larger corporations. And also, it is much more economical for individual practices to take care of patients than larger corporations.
That's another area that I think, on one hand, people might imagine, well, they're willing to give up the personalization so that they might have access to the greater variety of doctors that a large corporation or a hospital might bring to them. But you're right that that really hasn't happened either. When there are hospital mergers, it doesn't necessarily mean that patients have greater access to care across a variety of specialties.
You're right, Mitch. I think the full impact of these mergers and takeover, we still don't know yet.
You also write about the rise of hospital administrators. How is that phenomenon affecting the lives of both doctors and their patients?
So what has happened over the years is that the growth of active physicians has not increased, or maybe increased by 1% a year. But during that time, the growth of healthcare administrators has risen by about 3,000%. So if the physician pool is the same, why do we need an increase in 3,000% of administrators? What does that tell you?
What does that tell us?
So, they put in new regulations. You know, they create work for the physicians to do, which really does not affect the patient care as such. In fact, it's interfering, as I discuss in my book. And I think there's also evidence to show that the money that the administrators make is much more now than what the physicians are making. And the New York Times published not too long ago that the big bucks are made by people who administer healthcare rather than deliver healthcare.
In other words, the idea that having more administrators in place to rein in costs hasn't reined in costs at the end of the day.
I think you said it very well. The other thing is, for example, the insurance companies, they play a very important role in how we care for our patients. In the exam room, it's not just the patient and the doctor. There's another third person, and that's the insurance company.
They're not physically present, but they're felt.
Absolutely. And they tell the physician what to prescribe, when to prescribe, how to prescribe. And if the physicians want a particular medication for the patient, which they feel is appropriate, they will absolutely have all the control to say yes or no. And if they decide to say no, and if there's a consequences, they're not held liable, right? So meaningfully, they cannot be sued. They're above the state common law. So they get away with everything. Sometimes they don't even read the patient's notes that we submit. And to just tell you how things have gotten worse, my office, we have about 9 to 10 prior authorizations a day. I do peer-to-peer several times a week. That takes a lot of time and effort.
And ostensibly, in the peer-to-peer relationship, there is supposed to be a doctor on the other end who has the same information that you have and would logically come to the same conclusions that you would. But that is not always or maybe not even often the case.
Absolutely, Mitch. I'll give you an example. just, I did a peer-to-peer last week. As a patient of mine with multiple sclerosis who had failed two other treatments, and now I wanted to get the third-line therapy for this patient, and the insurance company had refused, so I had to do peer-to-peer. And this is exactly what happened. I dialed the number. There's a recording. It says, enter your physician ID number, and then the patient's text ID number, and then a live person comes in. It says, state your name and spell it. So I have to do all of that. I give my ID number, patient's name, spell it, give the text ID number. Finally, that person brought up on the screen, said, oh, you're going to do peer-to-peer? And I said, yes. Says, I'll connect you with somebody. So they connect me to another person. I have to repeat everything the same. You know, my name, spell it. And then you get irritated and you say, you know, I've already given all that info. And they say, well, we want to make sure it's the right person. So I give everything. Then he says, okay, I'm going to schedule an appointment for you to talk to peer-to-peer. And I said, no, I'm available now. I'll be happy to talk to you peer-to-peer. Oh, no, we will decide when our peer has the time to talk to you. So they gave me a time. And I said, you know, I've got a talk to give to the patients at that time. He says, too bad, you take it or leave it. If you miss that, that's it. That's the only chance you have. So I had to cancel my talk so I can take that patient, you know, peer-to-peer. And when the peer-to-peer came, it was somebody from not Wisconsin, I'm not even sure was licensed in Wisconsin, but it was an internal medicine doctor who could not even pronounce the drug that I was asking for. You know, when you have to deal with this every day, you get angry, you get frustrated, and then your whole day is shot. And then you have all these patients to see and electronic health records to deal with and the administrators to deal with. And, you know, everything adds up for the burnout.
Everything does add up. And you write that often it's when doctors complain, they're fired or they're shunned. Were you concerned at all about writing this book? First of all, whether other doctors would be willing to talk to you? And second of all, you know, what the consequences of writing the book in the first place might be?
You know, I wrote this book, as I indicated, when I interviewed more than hundreds of physicians around the country and hear their stories, their frustrations, their fear, and my own experience over the last 30 years. And then I did extensive research about what's written up by experts in the field. And I think the time is right for this book. I think all of the stakeholders in the healthcare, the lawyers, the politicians, the pharma company, the administrators, the patients, the doctors, everybody needs to know what we're going through. Because this is a healthcare crisis that nobody talks about. And unless we handle this and resolve these problems, we're heading for some difficult times. But the time is right for this book. And if I did not speak up, it would not be correct. In fact, it would be more riskier not to talk about it. Because I think we should, and we should be able to resolve these problems in a meaningful way. The purpose of this book is to try and get all of the stakeholders together. Sit down. Let's talk about it. How we can fix the problem. And I think that's the reason I wrote this book.
And clearly there are no easy fixes, but you do write that in the short term, there are things that doctors can do both to support themselves and to support each other.
And that's true. I think in order for physicians to make a meaningful change, we need to, first of all, take care of ourselves. Physicians have been in an abusive relationship for a long time. Physicians have been abused by healthcare administrators, by insurance companies. We have lost our voice. So we have been in an abusive relationship. So I think we need to heal from within as well. We all need to come together. As you know, it's against the law to collectively bargain as a group. And I think something has to change. I think we need to. When we are faced by this large, giant corporations with big hospitals, the physicians need to have a voice. And we need to collectively come together to be able to defend ourselves, not only for us, but this is for our patients. Because when the physicians suffer, we cannot take care of our patients. So the book is about not only the suffering of the physicians, but it's ultimately about taking care of the patients the best possible way we can.
Dr. Bhupendra Khatri, thank you so much for your work, and thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Mitch, for having me here.
Dr. Bhupendra Khatri is a Milwaukee-area neurologist specializing in multiple sclerosis. His recent book is called Healthcare 911, How America's Broken Healthcare System is Driving Doctors to Despair, Depriving Patients of Care, and Destroying Our Reputation in the World.
We'll take a quick break now, and then we learn about how Walker's Point came to be the central focus of gay life in Milwaukee. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. 1968 was a pivotal year for so many facets of American culture, from the anti-war and civil rights movements to rapidly changing musical styles to women's rights. It was also a time of great change in America's gay society.
While Stonewall didn't happen until a year later, 1968 was a crucial year in Milwaukee's gay history, especially in Walker's Point. Pride Month starts today, and we asked writer and historian Michael Takash to come in to tell us more.
1968 is very pivotal, and we are celebrating this golden anniversary this year of a year in which two very important things happened in Milwaukee that still inspire and influence us to this day. The first was the opening of This Is It, which is still standing at West Wells in Jefferson, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary this summer. But also, 1968 was the year that gay bars actually started flocking to Walker's Point and actually formed a neighborhood for LGBT people that had not been seen since the first, shall we say, gayborhood in the 400 North Plankinton block was demolished for 794 in the mid-1960s. So for quite a few years, there was nothing. Like, you know, these bars were destroyed. People were kind of distributed to the wind. But in 1968, a local businessman opened a bar at 181 South 2nd Street that had formerly been a bit of a go-go bar, a little bit racy, a little bit scandalous. And although he was not the first to the neighborhood, his arrival with the bar, The Rooster, actually sparked a whole migration and centralization of gay bars and gay businesses in the 100 South 2nd Street block of Walker's Point in a way that had never been seen before.
Why do you think Walker's Point was such a welcoming place? Or was it welcoming? Did people just show up?
Well, the Walker's Point that we envision today of tapas restaurants, wine bars, exotic chocolate shops was not the Walker's Point of the late 1960s. But it's interesting that in 1968, 50 years ago, we just really have this, you know, rust belt, kind of haunted looking, abandoned businesses, just all sitting there waiting to be discovered. And so in these areas of town where people no longer went, it was very easy for businesses to open that only were found by the people that they wanted to find them.
So in a way, it was a safe place to be.
I don't know how safe it was. I mean, there was still, you know, certainly Milwaukee was a bit more supportive, if not tolerant, city for LGBT people going back to all the way back to the 1920s. I don't know how safe it really was. There was still a lot of discrimination, obviously. There was still a lot of harassment. And certainly if somebody was, you know, found to be in one of these spaces or found to be, you know, holding hands or dancing or even sitting on a bar stool next to another person of the same gender, they could be arrested. They could be brutalized. In one celebrated case, they could even be murdered and nothing would be done about it.
Was homosexuality illegal in Milwaukee at that time?
Technically, it was not illegal, but bars were not allowed to serve homosexuals. So around the country, this was very common. A tavern owner could reject services to somebody simply because they were gay or because they were perceived to be gay, even stranger, right? I mean, walking into a bar, the business owner would make a snap decision on whether or not they could serve you. And that's why these special safe places needed to exist. Once you were inside, certainly they were safe to an extent. But, you know, walking around Walker's Point at night, moving from bar to bar on foot was probably not what most people did. So the idea that in 1959, which is unbelievable, right, like 6 decades ago, the first LGBT bar would open in Walker's Point at 901 West National is kind of unthinkable. I mean, you really think about this neighborhood and, you know, just being so industrial and so kind of like a workspace for Milwaukee, not really a play space. But as the work moved out, the play moved in, and the Nightbeat was really the first bar at 901 West National to cater to the LGBT community. It was strictly a women's bar. It was very, I guess the word that some contributors to the Wisconsin LGBT History Project have used is that it was a diesel bar. It was for women who were very tough. They knew what they liked, and they went there to find other women like themselves. And the bar owners created an environment where they could do that safely. It was not a bar that welcomed men. It was not a bar that welcomed women who wore makeup. But it was very popular. And from 1959 to 1963, it operated on 9th and National and then moved over to 2nd and Pittsburgh, which is actually, you know, when I say that 1968 is a pivotal year, there were traces of gay history happening in Walker's Point. But in 1968, they got a neighbor, and that neighbor was very popular.
All right. So 68 being, as you say, a pivotal year. And as we said at the beginning, 69 was a pivotal year nationally because that's when Stonewall happened. And for people who don't know, tell me the history quickly of the Stonewall.
Exactly. So the Stonewall Bar in New York's Greenwich Village had been operated by the mafia, and the mafia had taken cuts and kind of gotten some police protection. Well, that kind of fell apart, and the police took it out on the patrons and started harassing the patrons, harassing the staff, and it just got ugly and more violent, and things just escalated till one night when, you know, the community really came together and fought back. And it was the first uprising that achieved national attention, if not international attention, within the LGBT community. That was not the first uprising, certainly. The Black Cat Riot of Los Angeles was actually several years earlier. And even here in Milwaukee, much earlier, in 1961, there was a riot at a bar called the Black Knight, where some gentlemen came in and thought that they were going to come beat up some queers, were their words. They actually used that in the paper. That was their reason for coming to the bar, to start fights and beat people up. And the bar fought back. The bar was packed with 70 people on a Saturday night, and it fought back. And these guys like wound up in like intensive care for weeks. So there's really this simmering sentiment by, like, you know, the mid, certainly, and late, definitely, 60s, that people were not going to put up with being marginalized anymore. They were not going to put up with being brutalized. They were not going to be harassed anymore. They're not going to be chased, stalked, name-called. Like, they were really going to come out and just be like, you know, come at me. Bring it.
Has Walker's Point stayed the gayborhood in Milwaukee in these past 50 years, or has that changed? Have people found other neighborhoods that are equally welcoming?
You know, that's an interesting question. So when I was doing my research for the book LGBT Milwaukee, you know, it was interesting to me that the earliest gay bars in Milwaukee were kind of scattered. They were decentralized. They were all over town. I mean, there was one on North Green Bay Road in the 1960s. There was one on 20th and North. I mean, they were just literally all over the city. And it was hard to find them. There was no internet. There was no gay media. I mean, there is really no way of finding these places unless you knew somebody who knew somebody and they could get you in. Because, of course, they were not open to the public. Like, you couldn't just walk in. You had to, like, get in. So what's interesting about the story, really, is that, you know, in 1968, we start to see the forming of the second neighborhood of bars, which the freeway 794 sought to, like, decimate. It was like that block was known by the police, and the police in particular, one police officer harassed that block for most of his career. So when it was torn down, there was this hush of relief that, you know, the gay neighborhood was gone. And I don't think, you know, today's gay and lesbian people even know that there was ever a gay neighborhood there because it's a freeway off-ramp at Plankinton Avenue. So the idea of, like, having a neighborhood, having a collective place where you could go from bar to bar and see who was there or go to the neighborhood for the whole evening and, you know, bar hop, really didn't exist after the first neighborhood was destroyed. So in 1968, when the Nightbeat was joined by the Rooster across the street, it really created this sense of, okay, maybe there's something here. And then the next year, the Castaways Bar moved to the former Nightbeat place. Nightbeat moved across the street next to the Rooster. And now we had three bars on one intersection. The next year, a bar opened called the Seaway, which had migrated from Jefferson and Mason across the street from the Pfister. I mean, talk about like prime real estate, right? And now we had four bars on the same block. And then a restaurant opened in between what is the Rooster and the Seaway called the Night Owl. So then we had five businesses on the same block. This just kept happening. This just kept spiraling. And then bars started opening on the 200 South block of South 2nd Street. And by 1974, there were eight bars in two blocks, and there was a real neighborhood. And I just think that's fascinating. And then bars started spilling around the corner onto 1st Street, and then they started spilling into the 3rd Ward, and then they continued to push south. What I think is interesting is that the first bar in the southern part of Walker's Point, which we think of as traditional Walker's Point, you know, the Clock Tower, 2nd and National, the first bar in that area was actually Your Place, and Your Place opened in 1965, I believe. And it was opened by a Hungarian family, a gentleman named Jim Dorn and his partner. And Jim Dorn's parents opened this bar and lived above it. So it was kind of like a gay bar that was also family-owned and operated, which was unheard of at the time. But it all started at that corner of 2nd and Pittsburgh in 1968 when, you know, people saw that, you know, they saw themselves reflected in the world. They saw businesses that were welcoming and accepting. They saw that they, too, could have a neighborhood for them. And they just kept coming, and nothing could keep them away. And then more and more businesses came to tap into that. And then finally we had, you know, Walker's Point exploding with multiple bars and businesses continuing to this day.
Well, one of the ways you are marking this golden anniversary, you're having an event, but the event is really a way to collect more history. And so what are you asking people to do?
So one of the ways that we continued this research and one of the things that my book has funded is just continuous exploration, discovery, and crowdsourcing of rare historical content. Most of this content, you have to understand, is verbal. It's storytelling. People did not take cameras to bars before, you know, I was a teenager. So like by the 1980s, it was still uncommon to see people taking lots and lots of photos in bars unless they're at maybe a show or they were a drag performer. So the Wisconsin LGBT History Project website is really our repository. That's where we put the content that we harness, the stories that we write, the pictures we collect. But the collection process actually happens two ways. One is online through a History of Gay Milwaukee Facebook group, which was started by Jamie Taylor several years ago. It's a way of collecting photos. We've gotten T-shirts from bars. We've gotten matchbook covers, party flyers, an array of pictures from people, you know, private parties at people's homes. And it's really awesome because these parties bring people together. They start telling stories and this all just kind of flows naturally. And then people just really open up and it's great because they might not do that, you know, online and they might not feel comfortable doing that over the phone or in an interview setting like this one. But in a group of friends where they're just kind of doing like an open mic spoken word, you wouldn't believe the things we got. A year ago, we did a party at the former Fanny's, which is on Barclay in the southern end of Walker's Point, which was a women's bar for a long, long time. And we had over 200 women show up for this Remember When party. And the open mic session went for about 90 minutes with people just stepping up and sharing their stories. The first time they went to a gay bar, the first time they went on a date, what it was like to tell their parents they were gay, how they figured out they were gay in the 1960s. Coming downtown and, you know, avoiding the police or in some cases being supported by the police when somebody was harassing them. I mean, just really incredible stuff that way, way before my time. But all of that could be lost very quickly and easily if we don't start documenting it.
So, really, so you're recording these. People are willing to talk in the open mics and they are being recorded for posterity.
Yeah. So yeah. That's really the mission and purpose here, ultimately, of the Wisconsin LGBT History Project, which is affiliated with Milwaukee Pride, is to celebrate, document, and preserve this history because no one else is.
So what are you hoping to get from this particular event that you don't already have? Are you hoping to find out more about Walker's Point in 1968 or just personal stories?
We always see these Remember When parties as an opportunity to close some of the loose ends and the gaps in our collective history and knowledge. But this one is really special because, again, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of a bar that opened and kind of triggered a revolution before a national revolution even started. And, you know, to think that Al Berry, who was the founder of the Rooster, would buy this bar as a, you know, heterosexual husband, father, businessman, and would open this bar and create this space for people who at that time were kind of marginalized because their neighborhood had been flattened by the freeway steamrollers. We're really celebrating him and his decision to do that because, you know, honestly, I don't know that we would have the LGBT Walker's Point we have today had that linchpin not happen. It was kind of a domino effect. So we're first and foremost celebrating that. Second, bringing people together to talk about their memories of that bar, that block, that point in time. There are a great number of people, fortunately, still in Milwaukee from that period, from the late 60s, early 70s, who come together and share their memories and eventually start unearthing some things that we really didn't even know about. As I mentioned earlier, last year at the women's event at the former Fanny's, we discovered a bar that no one had ever heard of. And it wasn't listed anywhere in any documentation, any gay guides of the era, any gay press of the era. And we're still trying to dig into that one to find out where it was, who owned it, and what its story was. But that's the fun of this job, really. And this is a, you know, not a full-time job for me, but a volunteer labor of love, is discovering all of these, you know, points of interest and then digging deeper into them and then bringing the story alive for the rest of the city.
Michael Takash is a writer and historian. You can find more information about the Wisconsin LGBT History Project at WUWM.com.
We'll take another break, and then the tropical sounds of the Milwaukee band Paper Holland. The group's new album comes out today, and we'll get a preview when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. It's been a full 6 years since the Milwaukee band Paper Holland released its last full-length album. But the group never went away in that time. They played for a growing fan base, released an EP, and built anticipation for whenever the next album would come out.
Well, that time is at hand. Paper Holland plays a show this evening at Anodyne Coffee in Walker's Point to go along with the release of their brand-new album, Galapagos, an album whose sound is perfectly matched with the onset of tropical weather in Wisconsin. We had a chance to chat with a couple of the band's key members ahead of that show, guitarist and singer Joe Tomchek and guitarist Andy Kosanke. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
And so you both have these headphones on right now,
mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, a little bit of radio geeking out at the moment. But you are not that far removed from being in the studio putting together this latest album, which has to be there's a physical copy that is sitting with me. The physical copy is hitting the streets any moment now. But is this an exciting time?
Very. Yeah, definitely. We're super happy to have it out. And it's something that we've been working on for the past couple of years. So it's actually like kind of surreal to finally have like a physical copy of it because it's this just kind of like nebulous thing for so long when you're working in the studio and then it's finally done. So that does feel really good, and I'm just excited for people to hear it.
Yeah, definitely.
So it comes out today.
Comes out today.
All right. You heard it here first, literally.
Well, and so when you've been working on something for a few years and you have this physical thing in your hands, and presumably a virtual thing that people can download also.
Yes.
Is it also at some level a little nerve-wracking not knowing how people are going to react to it?
Yes and no. Yes, because you want people to like it, but no, because you have to not really care that much.
Or like, you just can't control it too
well,
much.
You can't control it, so you can't obsess over it. Also, if you do let it kind of get into your brain, it starts to affect what you make, and then you're kind of like catering, and you're not doing what you know, is what you do. So
yeah, I think you really have to make it for yourself first. Mm-hmm. And then of course, it's great if people like it. And that is part of the goal. I'd be lying if I
yeah,
said...
Yeah, you want people to like it.
Yeah, of course. But yeah, I think if you start off just trying to make music for yourself and that you like and that you'd want to listen to, I think that's kind of just the best way to do it for everyone.
You sort of have to accept that your fans are your fans for a reason. They came to you already, and so I would assume you want to trust that they are going to stick with you.
Yeah, you hope so.
Yeah.
That's always the hope, that you don't alienate people, even when you're trying new things. Like we definitely spent more time crafting this one, so hopefully it's something that people like and don't feel like... we've abandoned them with additional reverb and delay.
They lost me at the reverb.
They lost me in the ambience.
So we were talking in the lobby of the radio station, actually, a little bit about reverb before before we came into the studio. You have this Julian Baker T-shirt on that you're wearing today.
Every day.
Well, and if we were going to draw that Venn diagram of Paper Holland and Julian Baker, the overlap is in the pedals she uses. Is that right?
Yeah. I saw a video from a company called Walrus Audio that they had her in their studio or their warehouse. I'm not sure where they film it. They had her in, and she was playing, I think, Sprained Ankle or one of the songs from her first album through their pedals, and I kind of was just really loved the sound of what she was getting, and I got turned onto that company, and now I own a bunch of their pedals, and they're just, there's definitely some sonic overlap, even though I think being a full band, it's kind of hard to tell in parts, but yeah, there's definitely, we're using similar guitars, similar amps, similar effects. So. When you know that I would play again.
There are a lot of people who have made the comparison between you and some bands that go all the way back to the 80s and 90s, bands like The Cure. And, mm-hmm. I assume you don't set out to sound like someone else, but do you think there are bands that have kind of seeped into your consciousness that do shape what your sound is like?
I think definitely, yeah. Particularly the Beatles. I think for both of us, we've always been really influenced by them. Yeah, obviously they're just... this legendary force, and we, yeah, I think we set out to
probably
kind of,
later Beatles. I'm thinking,
kind of all of
yeah,
it.
My
dad played guitar, and I was raised like not knowing who the Beatles were, but knowing these songs that my dad played, and then I would hear them on the radio and be like, "This is one of Dad's songs." the Stones, the Doors, all these
things.
They
ripped my dad off.
I hope he's getting royalties for this. A six-year-old making sure my dad's getting paid.
Just cracking open a PBR. Dad, do you know about this?
Yeah, so I've known the Beatles my whole life, and then, not too long into my life that they're this, amazing band that has a absurd discography of... impressive music.
Yeah, and I think sort of the accessibility of their music and the singability, the catchiness, just like which I think is like a lot of what's at the core of pop music. I think that's a lot of what we set out to do. We don't necessarily limit ourselves to within a genre, and we don't even really like have a starting point from song to song that's always similar. So I think that kind of that pop structure is kind of the thread through our music. And I think a lot of that for me does kind of come from the Beatles. But yeah, we have six people in our band, and we have a lot of just like really eclectic influences between all those people. So it's really interesting to see how it all comes together.
It's hard to listen to this album and not think this really sounds summery in some way. What is it that what is it that makes an album sound warm in that way?
I think for this album in particular, like part of it is just the name, kind of like cues you into this tropical vibe. Galapagos just sounds super tropical. And we also start off the record with like this like ambient beach noise. Like there's like waves and birds and stuff like that. So I think we definitely like set out to establish that vibe. Beyond that, I'm not really sure. It's kind of just like you kind of know like a summer jam when you hear it. And maybe part of that is just exactly that, like when you're hearing it, because maybe we put this song or we put this record out in winter and maybe it doesn't quite have those same vibes. But there is something to that. I think you're right.
Did you start with Galapagos in mind and everything kind of flowed from that, or did you have a handful of tracks and you thought this does have that summer vibe?
I think we had a couple. Seasick, I think, which is the second track on the record. So I think that was really the cornerstone to like what the record was going to be like, sort of thematically and sonically. I just like, I really grabbed onto that vibe, like that kind of has that summery vibe. And in Wisconsin, we're always like looking for some way to escape the cold, and the winter is just so long. So I think if you can't actually like physically vacation, it's really nice to have things that kind of take you somewhere nice and warm for a little bit. So,
you really could have released this in the winter.
We probably should have. That would have been a better market.
I wonder if we had released it in winter, if it had been getting, you know, like, it sounds very summery. I mean, there's definitely, like, that feel throughout the whole thing, but I wonder if it would have been...
Be sonic escapism.
Yeah. We're going to steal that.
Did not have the little trademark, the registered trademark.
You missed it. We've got it now.
So, are you both Milwaukee natives?
Yes.
Yep.
We were chatting about this before the interview began. We were talking about venues and really what's available both for people to go and see live music, but also for bands to play. And so let me ask you, what is your take on the live music scene in Milwaukee today versus where it was 10, 15, 20 years ago?
I think it's as good as it's ever been, if not better than it's ever been. I can't really speak to, like, maybe beyond 10, 15 years ago. But I think the Milwaukee music scene right now is as good as it's ever been. There are so many incredibly talented artists working right now, and a lot of them are working very collaboratively, and they're all just putting out, like, staggeringly good things constantly. And right now, like, it's hard to choose what show to even go to some nights. And, like, you know, a random Friday night, like, sometimes you'll have to choose between two incredible shows, and it's hard. Like, so I think Milwaukee right now is just as good and collaborative as it's ever been.
Do you think, given, I mean, the music industry is a lot different than it was 20 years ago, say, or certainly 30 or 35 years ago, is being collaborative a necessity now where it might not have been way back when? I mean, do you feel like you're in competition, or is it really bands supporting other bands and venues supporting you? And
I think Milwaukee is just very supportive. Like, I really don't feel a competitive element in Milwaukee. I feel people like feeding off of each other. And I think like social media has a lot to do with it, because I think that is kind of the force that ties it all together. Like, that's what is making the music scene in Milwaukee feel more collaborative and connected than ever. And I think a lot of the artists within Milwaukee utilize that extremely well. So I think that's part of it too, is kind of just the growth of social media and bands getting more savvy with it.
Yeah, definitely seeing, you know, bands releasing music that is really good just continues to raise the bar. And it's not competitive. It's driving. It makes you want to be better. It makes you want your record to sound better. your lyrics to have more meaning. You know, it increases everything. You are competing, but it's not to defeat someone.
So we've talked about a couple of the tracks on this album. I guess this is a great time to have either or both of you direct our attention to other moments on the new album that you wouldn't want to pass by people as they sit down and listen.
Well, we took some time crafting some longer intros and outros and bridging tracks and songs. So I guess sticking around for the whole song in general is something that I'd encourage people to do. I mean, it is very much like everyone has a shorter attention span now, and I think we're sort of challenging that. We feel like we've crafted something that's worthy of paying attention to.
Right. I said sit down and listen, and it dawns on me that there are probably a lot of people that it's been a while since they've just sat down and listened to something start to finish.
Yeah. And that's always the way that I've consumed albums is you know, giving it the full shot start to finish, and then, you know, whether or not you pick a few songs you like from there and go back. But
I was worried, too, on if people would kind of have the patience today to listen to an album that was, like, intended to be listened to from start to finish with longer intros and, like, transitions that connect. We actually, like, made sure that the transitions between songs were pretty short. So, like, each song kind of rolls into the next one. So, like, while there is a lot of kind of, like, ambient nonsense between the songs, like, it kind of pushes you to the next song pretty quickly. So, but also I would like to say that Andy here, he sang lead on two songs on the record, Slouches and Silver Lines, and that's the first time that he did that. So I would encourage listeners to check that out.
Everything I've heard has worked really well.
Oh,
so
thank you.
Thank you both so much. Congratulations on the new album. And hopefully we can have you in the performance studio one of these days.
Yeah, we'd love that.
Joe Tomchek and Andy Kosanke are two of the members of the Milwaukee band Paper Holland. Their new album is called Galapagos, and they'll play a release show this evening at Anodyne Coffee in Walker's Point. You will find more information at WUWM.com. And Paper Holland sends us into the weekend on Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Bonnie and I produce the show along with Joy Powers, Audrey Nowakowski, and production assistant Maddie Andre. This week, we also welcome our two newest staffers, interns Ben Binversi and Lauren Keene, to the Lake Effect family for the summer.
We get additional reporting from Susan Bentz, web support from managing editor Michelle Madernowski, and studio engineering from Jason Reavy. Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.